Welcome to another episode of The Antique Vintager, where each episode, Jeff Eller, The Antique Vintager, discusses vintage items from jewelry, watches, art, and items of vertu in relationship to the times they were made, incorporating history and items in a fascinating way. Remember, just because it's old doesn't make it valuable. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff and Ann Eller.
Everybody, we're ready for another episode of The Antique Vintager. Hey, I'm Ann Eller, and I am here with the true marvel of his time, the antique vintager himself, Jeff Eller. So how you doing today, Jeff?
Not 100, so I can't be antique, but I can be old. And I'm ready to go for you today, Ann.
Well, what are we going to be talking about today, Jeff?
The technological wonders of their ages, and that's for the last 600 years, and that's watches.
Watches really are amazing, and on our website, you'll be able to follow along if you just go to theantiquevintager.com and then go to the episode titled Watches. Technology always on the leading edge. So there'll be pictures posted there, and you'll be able to see what we're talking about if you just go to our website, The Antique Vintager. Look for the episode that says Watches Technology Always on the Leading Edge. So let's get started. Jeff, where does it all start?
Well, it all starts with nations becoming nation states. And one of the things that they did when they became a nation state was establish trade boundaries. And the number one thing starting in about 1500 AD, people desired clocks or watches. There was no watches to start out with. There was first case clocks and then smaller clocks, and eventually evolved down to the size of the so-called carriage clock.
Well, but, did we start with sundials?
Oh, yeah. But you're going back 2,000, 3,000 years.
Oh, okay.
We're only going back 600 years with the actual manufacturing of watches.
You know, everybody, when they think of watches, so just as a little aside, you think of the Rolex, the Patek Philippe, you know, the really expensive ones. But watches really have had quite a varied history, haven't they?
Well, they all started out expensive.
Okay.
In the beginning, a watch was only for the very elite of a country or something that was worked within the trade industry, being basically shipping. And I will say this, that the development of watches went hand in hand with almost any other improvement in manufacturing throughout the last 500 years. For instance, watches had a myriad of small gears and levers and little parts, and you had to be able to consistently manufacture those. Well, in the beginning, each one was handmade with files and saws, even the gears. Mm-hmm. But eventually people figured out, well, there's ways to do this more efficiently. And what they found out was, they could set up jigs, and a jig is a way of doing it quickly. We have a watch here that's from the 1700s.
What watch? Let's see. If you're on the website with us, that will be watch number one. Okay, number one. We'll start with number one.
It's a ship's chronometer. Now, why do I say ship's chronometer? Because one of the things that determine longitude and latitude is time, and they used the chronometer had to be accurate so they could locate their place on the planet. And in England, because they recognized that they had to have accuracy of timekeeping for the shipping industry, they set up a prize for whoever could come up with an accurate watch.
What was the prize?
The prize was more than 5 years' worth of high-priced labor. I mean, it was like, I believe that it was 10,000 pounds, and this was back in the 1700s, would be equivalent to several million dollars today.
If you could come up with an accurate watch, or accurate time,
a timepiece, yes. And from that, they developed a whole industry. And it was a very coveted industry. One of the most high-priced things that England exported or Germany exported or France exported were their timepieces. And eventually, that was one of the first industries, once we became separate from England, developed here. Prior to that, we weren't allowed to manufacture watches here.
Interesting. So, but you're into the pocket watch there. Now, that was a very big pocket watch.
It's a large size, but this was small size for the time.
Really? It's very thick.
It's thick because of the mechanics in it.
Okay. And so that kind of gives you the idea that that was a work in progress then.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And the rarity of this watch is still not reflected in the prices. I mean, this is like $2,500 type thing. But the surprising thing, for the price for its time, would have been somewhere around $17,000-$18,000.
Interesting.
If you make corresponding values for the time.
Okay, so the watches unto themselves were very expensive. That's one
extremely
thing.
Extremely expensive.
Exactly.
And then,
What about the carriage clocks, though?
Well, the carriage clocks came before the watches, and they were of a thing of a scythe movement. You went from case clocks down to the size of a carriage clock.
Okay.
Which is an improvement for portability, but not that big an improvement. The next improvement came down to the pocket watch, something that could be carried on the person. And the first pocket watches were about 6 inches across.
6 inches across?
They looked like a cartoon. They were that big. They were just a modification of the carriage clock.
Wow.
And then we went to the size of the pocket watches, and then we lessened the size of the pocket watches. And then we had the American industry making watches. And people don't realize that in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, up through 1930, one of the largest industries in the United States was watchmaking. Elgin had 150,000 employees.
Wow.
In a nation of less than 60 million people, it had 150,000 employees. The only industry that had more employees than the watch companies were the boilermakers.
Wow.
And the boilermakers had tens of thousands because everything was run off steam and every steam engine needed a boiler. But watches were second. And they were a high technology thing for that time. And the machinery developed to make watch parts became the machinery that made typewriters, adding machines, calculators, small instruments. The mirage of opportunity from that type of equipment, that type of machinery, was expanded many manifold off watch manufacturing. And one of the interesting things of that, and this will be just a quick thing on the history, is Hamilton Watch was probably the first equal pay employer.
For real?
For real. They started off with a company called Aurora Watch, and Aurora was the founders were very religious, and they took in widows and orphan girls. And if you sat beside a man, they paid equal pay for equal work.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. When we, you know, nobody talks about that today, do they?
No. I mean, it's kind of amazing that we've come full circle. The technology industry today is, again, the acknowledged equal pay for equal work.
Interesting.
Now, going back through some of the watches, we went on the ship's chronometer. We went to the pocket watches, and we have a Waltham here. The Waltham has 23 jewels. Well, the jewels are actually man-made rubies in the shape of a little donut, and they're used as bearings within the watch because the jewels don't wear the metal when it's in contact with it.
Now, that'll be number two, the Waltham watch, and there'll be pictures of the jewels and the movement so you can see how it actually works, and we could even post a little video that shows the watch working. All the watches that we have here are in working condition. And just for the record, they are available for sale. Okay.
Well, this one is 23 jewels. It's a Waltham. It's fairly rare. It is a accurate watch beyond most watches today. It wasn't until 1960 that more wristwatches were made than were pocket watches.
And, you know, the pocket watches was an industry unto itself for fashion.
Right.
Because you had to have the appropriate watch chain to hold it. You had to have the vest that had the pocket for it or the place to keep it so it was safe.
Yeah, the three-piece suit was there for the watch. I mean, it wasn't the other way around that the watch was a part of a three-piece suit. The three-piece suit was derived for the be able to carry a watch and cigars, basically those two things.
Wow. Now, As watches became more developed with the pocket watch, the size definitely changed. And one of the things that I think is interesting is to look at this Siemens, the first watch, pocket watch we talked at, and then look at that one. And then you've got a third one here that is even thinner.
Well, the thinness of the pocket watch was a desirable thing because it didn't bulge your coat or your waistcoat or the vest that you had. There's no bulge there or the watch pocket for the top of the trousers. None of that was convenient if you had a big fat watch.
Sure. So now price-wise, what happened to the prices of watches? We're talking about pocket watches,
Pocket watches had dramatic prices drop as people became more efficient on manufacturing and figured out ways to large-scale manufacturing. Elgin and Hamilton led the way on that, and Waltham was right behind them. And then they went from large-scale manufacturing to where they had the dollar watch. Now, the dollar watch sounds awful cheap, but here's the thing on the dollar watch. The dollar watch was 1/23 of a man's monthly salary. So it wasn't all that cheap.
But it was required. You needed to have this to show success and status, right?
That was one of the easy ways to show success. They may not see the carriage that you're in. They may not see the rail car that you ride in. They might not see anything else, but they can see you pull that watch out. And the gold watch was the epitome of status. It was the banker's watch.
The banker's watch. Now, prices today on, let's just talk a little bit about the prices today on the watches, the pocket watches that are here, just for example.
Well, the prices today reflect the fact that they are a collector's item, they are a use item still, but they no longer carry the price tag commensurate with the times. This Waltham, we have it in the case at $495. You have it on sale here for about $260. Well, let's put it in perspective. perspective is that when this watch was made, its dollars corresponding to today's dollars was something like $1,600.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And the other thing is there was always a watchmaker to fix your watch, to take care of your watch.
Most watches were lease serviced twice a year.
And the other thing that I think is very interesting, when you're looking inside the watches, you can actually see where the watchmaker repaired it, and he put his initials and he dated it. So you knew the authenticity of the repair.
Well, to put another fact out there that's rather surprising is that in 1900, when they did the census, there were 350,000 watchmakers.
Yeah. How many are there today, Jeff?
Less than 50.
Less than
50. 50,000 today.
Yes. And that's part of the problem. If you have one that's in good working condition, you really want to care for it carefully because it's getting harder and harder to, number one, find parts
right.
And find somebody that will work on it.
Well, when you figure there are 350,000 in 1900 when we had less than 70 million people, and we have only 50,000 now, and we have 360 million people, you can see the problem.
Exactly. So if you've got one, do take care of it. Now, let's just talk real quick. Now, you can always look at the items that we're talking about right there on theantiquevintager.com. We've talked about 1, 2. I think we should label the third pocket watch as number 3. That even shows a thinner pocket watch, and that one is an Elgin. That's right. So we should just note that one. But you can see those on our website as we're talking about the items. If you want to follow along with us, just go to theantiquevintager.com. Look for the episode called Watches, Technology, Always at the Leading Edge.
The last surge that we had of watchmakers and things was immediately after World War II. And one of the odd things of World War II was that one of the immediate strategic reserve things that they deemed was watchmakers.
They needed watchmakers?
They needed watchmakers in the industry. They needed watchmakers for the military. The watchmakers were the ones that assembled and maintained the bomb sites for World War II bombers.
Had to have really steady hands for that job.
Well, they weren't the bombardier. They were the ones that set up the bomb site for the bombardier.
Oh, okay.
They were too valuable to risk to put in an airplane that was likely to be shot down. So they were on the ground. They did the maintenance. They did the setup. They did the manufacturing even for the bomb sites. And that took well over 100,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, and at the end of World War II, all the watch manufacturers went together and set up watch schools all through the United States. And one of the things that they had then was that every corner literally had a watchmaker.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And we've seen pictures. And now it's very hard to find any of that. But, you know, one of the most popular watches, I think, was the railroad watch, wasn't it?
Oh, the railroad watch was kind of like the king of pocket watches for the average man. I mean, there was always custom pocket watches, but the railroad top end, the 992Bs, the buns, the balls, they were very top-end watches, sold for much more than a Rolex.
And they had to be, and the reason is because they were very accurate going through the towns.
They were very accurate for the set-up railroad schedules and trains. There were a lot more trains on the tracks at that time than there are now, of course, and it still had to be almost perfect. And navigation for the airliners and everything, every navigator on a major airline after World War II, of course, carried a 992B because it was so accurate. It was one of the most accurate production watches ever made, if not the most accurate.
And you had to have one of those if you worked on the railroad. You know, in our area, we have several crossroads of the railroad and, of course, big contingency of those that work on the railroads. So we're going to show you pictures, and I think we've got a little video that goes with it on the railroad watch, the 992B. That would be number four, right? Number four on the website, The Antique Vintager.
Number five, it's thought to be the watch I have on. The watch I have on was made for German Luftwaffe during World War II.
What does that mean?
German Air Force.
German Air Force, okay.
Come to the end of World War II, the Swiss, being very practical people, had already been probably paid by the Germans to make these watches, had hundreds of thousands of works on hand. They just renamed them and called them Sabrina and sold them through the BX in the American zone of Germany, and they distributed them throughout the world that way.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's a chronometer, and it has a stopwatch function, and it's super accurate.
What's a chronometer?
Super accurate.
Meaning it's accurate because?
It's accurate to a certain standard. It loses less than 3 seconds a day.
Okay. And what other functions? Got a stopwatch function on it?
It has a stopwatch function and a elapsed time indicator, and so that you could compute your distances and your flight times just by looking at your wrist.
Now, that was a marvel.
It still is. Still is. Yeah. The multifunction watch is one of the highest sellers there is for the status-seeking young man.
Yeah, and, you know, when we talk about watches, you know, there was a time where watches really kind of fell out of favor because everybody was so into their smartphone.
Well, the smartphone is nothing more than a continuation of the watch. It combined the phone with the watch. So it's a watch.
Right.
It's just in a smartphone.
Correct. But what I was getting ready to say is, though, that people have come back to watches, and collectible watches as a market is really a hot market. It's one of the biggest selling groups of items that we have.
We continuously sell these, and we sell them to not only collectors, we sell them to the people that want the panache of having that 60, 70, 80-year-old watch on their arm that's still very functioning, very functional, and can provide some conversation. Not everybody has one.
Now, I know one of the things that you love seeing is some of these old watches and doing the research. And again, if you haven't heard any of our other podcasts, you may not know it, but the catalogs were a great way to find out knowledge. And that's one of the ways that you learn a lot of your knowledge is by studying the Sears and Roebuck catalogs and Montgomery Ward catalogs. All these catalogs provide a lot of information.
Well, we have the watch distributors catalog, so we don't even have to guess on it. And the nice thing about watches, all watches virtually have identification numbers in them, and you can equate those numbers to the year and even month that they were manufactured. And you can very quickly then go to a price list and see what that thing sold for when it was made in the 20s, the 30s, 40s, or 50s. And it's quite amazing that we are here 40, 50 years away, and we're back to selling something that is very much close to the same price that it sold for back then. Watches were never cheap.
Right.
And we had an illustration there of a watch that we've sold that was a combo. It was a pocket watch size set up to be used as a pocket watch and or a wristwatch. You could change it over as you wanted.
Yeah, that would be number six on their website. Now, this watch is very cool because if you see it sitting in the case, and it's actually, it looks like a pocket watch just sitting there, a small, almost, it is a lady-sized pocket watch, but it's got a little loop on the bottom, and the bracelet actually fits in on either side to make it into a watch. Now, how'd they come up with that idea?
Actually, that was one of the things they came up with because people were using watches in manufacturing and it kept their hands free. That was one of the things. The other thing was the pilots, early fighter pilots, like to be able to look at their wrists much easier than pulling a pocket watch out.
Right. So that's a really neat piece. Unfortunately, we have sold that one. We don't see many of those because that's pretty rare.
It's even rarer when it was in the original box. I mean, it had the original price on it, the original box, the whole thing.
You're right. Now, what do we know what the make of that watch was?
That was Elgin.
That was an Elgin. Okay. All right. So that's number six on the website, The Antique Vintager, if you want to see what that one is. But a very cool piece. And I believe there's even a little video that we shot before we sent it off to that lucky owner of that watch. So check that one out on The Antique Vintager. Now, Jeff, I know one of the things you want to talk about, some of the more watches, but I think we need to tell people if they have watch or watches or even other items. It doesn't have to be. We're talking about watches today. But you always are helping people establish what it is they have. And you help them also if they're looking to acquire something or sell things they have.
We could buy it from them, sell it for them, or get it repaired sometimes.
Right.
But what we have is the capability to showcase these particular types of watches. We have people that come to us looking for them now.
That's right. So if you're looking for a particular watch, make sure you let us know. You can email us right from the website, The Antique Vintager, and you will be able to send us a message. If you want to send us some pictures and show us what you've got, Jeff will look at it and respond back to you. We love hearing from the people that are involved with us with our podcast. We also, if you're looking for something, don't hesitate to give us an email. You can even call us, but give us an email and tell us what you're looking for.
The thing about antique watches, the old watches here, is that they went for style. The watches today have name identification, but basically the style is the same. It's a round face.
It's big.
These were made to fit the mechanism when the concept was the smaller the mechanism, the more valuable that the work that went into it was. And the larger number of jewels was a catalyst for the price. Now, the outside cases, they were styled by some of the most famous designers of their time.
Okay.
All of them. They just didn't put it in a square case or a round case. They had some design and some design elements that went with it. And the bands went along with that.
Sure. Some of the 1940s, the what's the style? The
Tourneau.
The Tourneau, the long square rectangular-shaped one. I think one of the other thing that's very interesting, you may have noticed how many men's watches are being worn by women because the men's watches weren't really that big either.
No, the man's watch, the concept wasn't to have it huge. It was to have it smart was the term they used for it.
Smart.
Smart. It looks smart. And way over half of the watches we sell that are men's watches at that time are being worn by women.
Exactly.
Yeah, way over half.
And we have a lot of men, women buying pocket watches for men for groom's gifts, for really special occasions. So the watch today is still something that is treasured and should
it's
be looked for.
It's an instant heirloom. And you don't own it. You're just a protector of it.
You just possess it until you hand it off to the next generation. And who said that? Patti Philippe. That's their philosophy. You never own a Patti. You simply possess it to pass it on. It's a good thought. It's a good thought. It's a very good thought.
It's a quality idea of a quality product.
Yeah. So what we're now, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about some ladies' wristwatches here, some more men's.
Well,
what would you like to?
Ladies' wristwatch, the whole concept was dainty.
Yeah, you need a magnifying glass to be able to see it sometimes in today's world.
Well, the killer of the ladies' wristwatch was the size that they were able to obtain, which was very small.
Yes.
And the fact is that you can't covertly look at the time. You have to get it up close to be able to see it, type thing. Well, that was always the thing where the guy knew the gal wasn't very interested anymore.
She got her watch out,
was winding it while he was talking, and, you know, got it up close to her face to where she could see the time. Did the yawn, you knew you were lost for a date. That was the whole thing. But they were even harder to produce than the men's watches.
Really?
Yeah, really. But nowadays, for $100 to $150, you get a quality antique piece that has beauty and function, and it'll be one of a kind, literally.
Well, I know one of the other things that's really cool about the watches is the different type of bands. For example, that watch that you have right there, that's a, what's the brand on that one?
This one?
Yeah.
Bulova.
It's a Bulova, and that'll be number 7. It has that black cord band that was so prevalent. And I think the other thing we need to mention when we talk about fashion, and we haven't really talked about fashion that much, but that fashion dictated that you had the cocktail watch,
right,
and then maybe you had a work-type watch or a daily watch.
Well, the cocktail watch usually had diamonds around it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the band, although it could be cord, was usually very simple. Even if the band had diamonds in it, it was not very ostentatious, very simple. It wasn't designed to be splitting wood with. It was designed to wear to a function.
Sure. And so those were very dainty. So you needed to have more than one watch.
Well, the cocktail watch, nowadays, we sell them in 14 carat, 18 carat, even some in platinum. Most are under $1,000. And surprisingly enough, when they sold in the 50s, they were close to $1,000.
The platinum ones you're talking about.
The platinum ones,
right.
Yeah.
Now, we've got a gorgeous platinum one here that has a white cord band. It is in platinum. It has diamonds, and it is quite lovely. What can you tell us about that one, Jeff?
This one actually had one of the first small settings. The works in it are about the size, less than the size of a dime. It was a Swiss watch that was sold through Macy's. It was the Elegant Watch Company. Well, the Elegant Watch Company was a generic name that Macy's came up with to be able to promote and sell. The word elegant just seemed to be enough connotation to sell by itself, and the fact that it was sold in Macy's, guaranteed by Macy's. By the way, this watch had a 10-year guarantee.
Wow.
It was not cheap when it sold. We're selling it, even today, we're selling it for like $1,800.
Yeah, it's a beauty. Now, that's number 8, if you want to take a look on our website, theantiquevintager.com, the Elegant Watch, and that was actually a Macy's brand watch. Now, branding became a big thing. Tiffany's had the Tiffany's watch and
the
all
Tiffany's watch was nothing more than Tiffany put their name on Omega or Geneve or even Rolex.
Rolex.
Yeah, now Rolex pulled out of Tiffany because Tiffany put their name on Rolex.
What'd they do, just scratch off? We're taking the Rolex off and we're going to put our name on it. Tiffany, boom.
People think Rolex was as popular to 50 years ago or 60 years ago as it is today. The thing that made Rolex popular, Sir Edmund Hillary climbing Mount Everest wearing a Rolex, and the fact of all the James Bond novels.
Yes. And today, it's still a popular watch. Now,
it's a status watch.
Yes.
Status watch meaning it doesn't necessarily run any better than some of the other watches. It's a very rugged watch. It's a well-designed watch. It can take a lot of abuse. But actually, the Hamilton 992, more accurate.
Well, is it one of the problems is with the Rolexes, it's an automatic movement, which we really haven't addressed here today, whereas a wind-up watch, you know, if you wind it every day, you're going to keep that accuracy to it. But an automatic, you have to keep moving or put it on a watch winder in order to keep it accurate.
Well, one of the things they always showed on Rolex watches is they made it a sports watch. They used to show all the athletes that were not on a ball field wearing the Rolex, but the tennis players wore it, golf players wore it.
Jack Nicklaus, yep.
It had to be. It was a young man's watch. And quite frankly, what you get oftentimes, if we sell it to a really older person, they don't move around enough to keep it wound.
That's true. And that's why I brought that up, because that was an innovation and supposed to be a good thing, but it can also be a detriment if you don't move around enough.
Well, here's the other thing is that used Rolexes right now are selling cheaper than they've ever been in the last 25 years.
Why is that?
Because the public's, the millennials, shall we say, the third generational watch buyers.
The new buyers
are buying the $600 and $1,200 phones with the watch function rather than the watch. That's their status symbol, not the Rolex. Still plenty of people buying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't feel sorry for Rolex. They're still China.
Still doing okay.
They're still doing very well.
And in China,
know,
they're still really popular.
When
okay.
you read in the trade papers that they have a supply on hand, they have a year's supply on hand or something like that, then they have something to worry about. But right now, they have never reached a point where they saturate the market.
Well, today we've talked a lot about, and we really haven't addressed this, the wind-up aspect of all these watches. We hadn't really gotten into the battery-operated. We've talked about these marvelous works of art that have to be wound to be kept accurate. To
and
keep
how
going.
Many people have walked in this door and said, watch don't work. I only had it for a day and it stopped. And you wind it and they look at you and say, what'd you do?
That's right. Well, I brought that up because these are marvels, but these, all the watches we've talked about, except for the Rolex, which is an automatic. Did we have any other automatics on the table here?
Oh, yeah. Everybody just about has the same basic design automatic. It's a pendulum inside of a watch case that does the function of the twist dial
to make it wound, yes.
To make it wound.
Yes. Yeah. So that's why if you're moving a lot during the day and you're wearing the watch, it winds the watch, and therefore it would run like overnight. But if you don't perpetually move, which is what we were talking about with the Rolex, sometimes older people don't move around enough, and therefore it doesn't keep it
and
wound.
Actually, it's the speed at what you move. It's the quickness of the motion that forces that pendulum to oscillate.
One more thing. People can overwind a watch, which is very interesting in today's world. People don't know how to wind a watch.
We go over every watch that we sell. We give them instruction, and we usually go face-to-face and show them how to wind it. Unfortunately, where it comes in is where somebody gives it to somebody, and that person didn't get the instruction.
Sure. And you can overwind it, so you don't want to overwind it. You know, if you want more information about how to operate your watch, you can go right on our website, The Antique Vintager. Look for the episode, Watches Technology, Always on the Leading Edge, and you'll be able to find instructions. We'll have little videos. We've got a whole little package we've put together to make the watch experience come alive for those that didn't grow up with it, right?
That's true. And the fact is that a vintage watch sells for cents on the dollar compared to what a brand new mechanical watch sells for.
Do they still make mechanical watches?
Yes, for very high prices.
Okay. All right.
Ours, the exact same movement, everything else, but it's 60 years old. Sells for maybe 25% of what a new watch that is restricted delivery. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something special to buy a new mechanical watch.
Now, one of the things we need to go over, though, is a mechanical watch, a wind-up watch, will never be as accurate as a quartz, as a battery watch.
Never.
I mean, you know, when they say Timex, it takes a licking and keeps on ticking, they are truthfully true about that, right?
That's true.
I mean, it is a different. If you want something, though, that is quality, or if you have something like this and you've always wondered, it was grandma's watch, it was granddad's pocket watch, you have a marvelous piece, but it needs to be taken care of, and you need to understand it'll never be as accurate as that quartz or as that smartphone you have.
When Swatch first came out with the quartz watches type thing, one of the ads they put up was a Swatch for, I think, like $20, and then right alongside the Swatch was later Rolex, and the price of the new Rolex, I think, at that time was $4,000 or $5,000. And it showed a guy timing it and said the Swatch was still perfect. Well, it had to be because it's quartz.
Exactly.
It's not affected by humidity. It's not affected by your movement. It's not affected by a magnet that you walk by or anything else. It's not affected. It has some variation. So your $10 quartz is going to be as accurate or more accurate than your $10,000 Rolex. But then again, if you're on that desert island, your mechanical one can keep right on ticking for years, and your quartz is done after a couple of years. Yeah, 6 months or a year type thing. You're sitting there with a dead watch, but the guy with the mechanical still can tell you the time that it is in San Francisco. Your desert island still is connected to time.
Well, there you go. So there's a reason to have a mechanical watch, folks, because you never know when you may end up on a desert island and you may need to be able to tell time. Having a sundial just won't do it, but a mechanical watch will.
Well, one of the interesting things is that I don't know if they still do it or not, but years ago when I was in the service, the military bomb shelters all had mechanical watches.
How about that? So interesting, the things that you can learn on our podcast, The Antique Vintager, with the one and only Jeff Eller. As always, Jeff, you've enlightened us. I mean, things that I think I know a lot, but every time I sit down and you and I talk, I always learn so much more. So make sure you check out The Antique Vintager. Hey, folks, if you've got a watch, you don't know what it is, or you'd like more information about it, don't hesitate to go to our website, The Antique Vintager. You can email us, you can send us pictures, you can call us. Any of these methods of contact would be great, and we would love to hear from you. In fact, the telephone number, 864-229-6613. We are right here in Greenwood, South Carolina, but with the internet and everything else, We're only a telephone call away. So how about, folks, let's wind it up. Wind up the watch, folks. You got anything else you'd like to add here, Jeff?
That'll be it.
That'll be it. Thanks for being with us, the antique vintager himself, Jeff Eller. That'll do it for us. Check out the website, The Antique Vintager. Bye-bye. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Antique Vintager. Make sure to visit our website, theantiquevintager.com, for video clips and pictures of the show. Jeff also looks forward to your questions and comments. While you're on the website, theantiquevintager.com, don't forget to sign up for email notifications. Tune in next week for The Antique Vintager. Bye-bye.